That's Randy Weston with Marrakesh Blues. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It's Tuesday, May the 21st, and the suburbs of Oklahoma City, especially the town of Moore, are still reeling from the devastation caused yesterday by a powerful tornado that, with little warning, developed into a 200-mile-per-hour juggernaut that shredded everything in its path. A massive search and rescue effort involving thousands continues in Moore, which took a direct hit. Officials say 24 people have died, including 9 children from an elementary school. Well, we'll be talking about two subjects today. And the first would be about what's going on, an alarm that has been issued about the piece of legislation awaiting signature of the governor of Florida, Governor Rick Scott, to speed up executions, and there are 404 people on death row in Florida. What is the implication of this piece of legislation? And for that, we have our guest, Mark Maurer. He is the director of the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C., which researches and works for reforms in sentencing policy, addresses unjust racial disparities and practices, and advocates alternatives to incarceration. Thank you, Mark, for being with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, this piece of legislation is called the Timely Justice Act, which seeks to speed up executions, and if signed into law, which is what many people are hoping here in Florida, they just can't wait to dispose of 404 people. The governor must sign a death warrant within 30 days after a review by the state Supreme Court, and schedule an execution within 180 days. First, what is your position on this Timely Justice Act?
Well, I think it's just a horrendous piece of legislation. You know, regardless of whether one supports or opposes the death penalty, certainly it should be in everyone's interest that if it is going to be imposed, that it be done so that any possible error could be minimized. And this just makes a mockery of any sort of reasonable appeals process, reasonable investigation process that could actually, significantly increase the odds that innocent people would be executed under its provisions.
But what does your gut tell you? Is it going to become law, or is it going to be at least a last-minute fight?
Well, I know there will be a fight. There's been a very strong movement challenging the death penalty in Florida for many years. At the same time, there's clearly strong legislative support there, and the governor has certainly been not overly concerned with how the death penalty is applied. So I don't pretend to be an expert on Florida politics, but certainly there is a lot of momentum towards adopting the legislation.
What are the peculiarities of death sentences from your point of view?
Well, as the Supreme Court has said, death is different, and in many ways. But the most significant one is that if you make an error in the death penalty, it may be too late. If you discover after an execution that someone in fact was not guilty of the crime, and as terrible as it's been to see so many cases of people spending 10, 20 years in prison before their innocence could be proven, at least there's always that chance of that happening if you don't employ the death penalty. And we know there's just been enormous numbers of cases showing this. Florida alone has had 75 executions in the 40 years since the 1970s. During the same time, there have been 24 wrongful convictions documented on death row in Florida. So that's hardly a good ratio to be proud of, and just suggest that if you minimize the amount of time available to try to prove innocence, it's almost inevitable that the numbers of people wrongfully convicted will not be discovered and executions may take place.
With regard to the issue of race, what also is peculiar about death sentences?
Well, a long line of research going back to the 1980s shows that there are probably two most significant variables that determine which people charged with murder ultimately receive the death penalty. The first is the quality of your defense attorney. It shouldn't be any surprise that if your attorney comes to court drunk or sleeps through part of your trial or is inexperienced, you will have a higher risk of achieving the death penalty, and that's unfortunately been very well documented. And the other variable is race, and what the research consistently shows is that the key issue here is the race of the victim. Those people who kill a white person, roughly speaking, have about a 4 times greater chance of receiving a death sentence than if you kill a black person, all other things being equal. This research goes back, beginning in the 1980s, the late David Baldus was one of the key scholars here, in a Supreme Court case in 1987 called McCleskey. Professor Baldus' research was presented to the Supreme Court, showed very clearly race was a factor in the state of Georgia. The Supreme Court rejected the argument then, and essentially what their reasoning was that while they didn't necessarily quarrel with his research, that Mr. McCleskey, the defendant, could not prove that race was a factor in his particular case. Well, that's setting such an enormously high bar of proof, because obviously neither the prosecutor, the judge, the jury, you know, is going to say, well, you know, race played a role in how they came to their determinations, and in fact, they may not be conscious of how race may be involved. Much of this may involve unconscious bias, stereotypes, and the like. So the Supreme Court has really set a standard that makes it extremely difficult to make this argument about the impact of race in the application of the death penalty.
Well, since you mentioned the Supreme Court, let's talk about Congress. Now, here's a situation in which clearly there are grave concerns about the likelihood or the odds of convicting somebody who may very well be innocent in a case in which he or she will forfeit his or her life if found guilty. In as much as this is the case, in as much as the preponderance of this particular phenomenon exists throughout the United States, how is it that we do not have a universal approach to this, as opposed to one that insists that this is a matter for the states? This is a states' rights issue, and the states themselves are to decide how they're going to deal with the death penalty.
Well, you know, the problem is, you know, with our criminal justice system, our sentencing laws in general, you know, unless cases are specifically of federal jurisdictions, you know, our Constitution does give the states essentially the right to establish a criminal justice system, to determine what the penalty should be within that system, and the like. So, you know, it's not necessarily inappropriate. It does lead to, you know, extremely broad variation in how penalties are applied. Today, about 18 states have abolished the death penalty. The other states maintain it. There's certainly momentum towards abolition. A half dozen states have abolished the death penalty in recent years. But, you know, like it or not, this is one of those areas where it is left up to the states. Now, the federal government could do much more in terms of supporting indigent defense and making it high quality across the country. It could do more supporting research around the death penalty and how what the outcomes look like. So there are things the federal government or Congress could do, but in terms of the penalty itself, either it will ultimately be found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court or else on a state-by-state basis, we will continue to see momentum to chip away at its use around the country.
Well, there is also the matter of international pressure. The United States, as a, quote, superpower, unquote, remains singular in the, in its aspect of the death penalty and the application of the death penalty in situations that are clearly prejudicial and clearly have implications in terms of race, which in the eyes of, you know, the larger community raises a question of human rights abuses. How is the international influence being felt on the national policy?
Well, you're correct that there's, you know, increasingly concern around the world, I think, about the U.S. use of the death penalty. You know, among industrialized nations, the United States is almost alone in still maintaining the death penalty. Japan does have a death penalty system, although the numbers are quite small there. But, you know, all of Western Europe has abolished the death penalty. In Europe, you know, membership in the European Union is premised in part on a state abolishing the death penalty as well. So the United States is increasingly isolated among its sort of contemporaries on this issue. And there's been, you know, a number of international tribunals and commissions, you know, strong public disapproval of policies here. There, from time to time, some nations have threatened to boycott doing business with states such as Florida or Virginia that maintain high rates of execution. So the international pressure is there. You know, I think that in itself won't be sufficient to do away with the death penalty, but it's yet one more tool that's being used along with the other critiques and advocacy campaigns on the death penalty.
When you talked a little while ago about the racial aspect of it, is there also a kind of supremacist gratification, for lack of a better term, that a state or a system derives a certain degree of satisfaction by fulfilling what it construes to be the attitude of the people, that especially in cases where you have a white victim and an African-American or Latino or non-white perpetrator, that there is this carryover from dark days past, that this is the way to punish. They get a sense of psychological satisfaction of literally underscoring the point of the value of the life of whites versus the value of the life of non-whites.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's difficult to quantify that, of course, but certainly, you know, the history of racial supremacy in this country, you know, can't be disassociated from our consideration of these developments. And, you know, one can never know. It's a sort of evolving climate and culture around these issues. You know, we would like to think that particularly progress made in the last half century around race relations has been largely positive. We live in a different society than we did before the beginnings of the modern civil rights movement. At the same time, we can hardly say that race is not a consideration in, you know, how we structure society and what outcomes look like and the like. And so, yes, there may be some sense of satisfaction that appeals to some people. I think in part the death penalty is maintained because we've had a very divided, limited political debate about it. You know, if you do public opinion polling and ask people if they support the death penalty, you get majorities who say yes. if you provide other options, life in prison, life without parole, restitution to victims, along with that, support for the death penalty then drops often 15 or 20 points. So I think we need to have a broader conversation, not only just about the morality of the penalty, but also the practical nature of it and the considerations that come into it, and have a much broader discussion than we typically do on these issues.
Well, coming back to Florida, is it too late to impress upon Governor Scott the significance of this piece of legislation that is on his desk?
It's never too late until the governor picks up the pen and signs a document. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, this battle is not being waged on science and rational analysis, but rather on political considerations and sort of gut instincts. And, you know, I think the challenge is to make it uncomfortable enough for the governor to sign the bill, to highlight, you know, the all the very problematic issues that will come out of this, and just to, you know, put enough pressure that the governor doesn't see any political advantage in signing that. I think that's what it would take, and, you know, there's not a lot of time to make that happen, but I think that's, you know, that's the possibility of trying to encourage him not to go ahead with this.
And even if he does, all is not lost, you think? Even if he does sign it, the legislation, there is still the opportunity to make some kind of an impact on it, you think?
Well, it's going to be difficult. You know, when the legislature passes a bill, it can always be revised or repealed. You know, realistically speaking, that doesn't normally happen very quickly after a bill is passed. So it would require quite a bit of mobilization, perhaps a change in leadership at the top. There might be legal challenges that could be brought to such legislation, and I'm sure that some of the advocates are already thinking about that. So by far, of course, the most effective outcome would be to encourage a governor not to sign it in the first place. If he should, I'm sure that there will be ongoing campaigns designed to try to repeal it, to minimize its impact and the like.
In your world, the world of advocates, are you, as a group, changing some of the tactics, in as much as this is the reality that you have to deal with? Is there a discussion going on about how one continues to defend in an atmosphere that is so openly hostile, but yet very well organized against defendants who may very well be innocent?
Well, I think, there is some encouraging news in the anti-death penalty movement. There's been a real shift over the last decade or so, where once there were about 100 executions a year taking place, say, in the 1990s, that figure has been cut in half in recent years. So a substantial decline there. As I mentioned, a half dozen states have abolished the death penalty in recent years. State of Maryland, just this month, the governor signed into law a repeal bill. Also, I think the innocence movement has been extremely effective. You know, the stories that they have been able to document, tragically showing, hundreds of people either on death row or unjustly convicted in non-capital cases, I think have really brought home to many Americans the problems with this kind of a process, and, the extreme problems through legislation proposed in Florida. So there's clearly momentum on the issue. Obviously, we're still a long ways off from complete abolition, but I think the combined arguments, the imagery, the organizing, have had an impact, and I think are likely to continue to do so in the coming years.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for this really incredibly informational, although brief, interview with you today. But it was important to keep tabs on this phenomenon of the death penalty surprisingly gaining ground just when one would think it should be reconsidered. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, too.
Thank you. And now we go to Washington, D.C., where the most recent labor statistics are showing the devastating effect of unemployment in several key states and the persistence of race as a major factor in the growing numbers of people without jobs. Doug Hall is the director of the Economic Analysis and Research Network of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, along with a research analyst, Mary Gable. He has done a series of profiles on the impact of unemployment in America, but found cause for even greater alarm in the most recent unemployment figures. Thank you, Doug Hall, for being with us today.
Well, I appreciate your interest in this story. It's a very important
I certainly
one,
do. Normally, when people do stories like this, as analysts tend to be quite unemotional and straight to the facts and just the facts, ma'am, kind of thing. But it was impressive when I read that your preamble to the report recently saying, never before in EPI, that's the Economic Policy Institute's history, has our work on jobs and unemployment been more critical or more widely recognized than it was over the past 2 years, a period marked by persistently high unemployment, reduced hours, and lost wages. That's quite emotional, if you don't mind me using that word, but it is a clue, although it sounds understated in a way, but in your world, this is dramatic writing. So what was it about the past 2 years that caused you to believe that the numbers that you've been looking at are so dramatically important?
Well, I think what you're speaking of is a sense that we have here that this country as a whole has not been paying attention to the right issues. You know, we're focusing on these invented crises around the deficit and the debt, when what we should be focusing on is the human toll that ongoing joblessness is taking, not just amongst African-American workers in Michigan, but in fact workers of all races and ethnicities across the country. And it does upset us, and you're right that it's a challenge for us to walk that fine line, trying to keep our emotions in check so as not to undermine the very importance and the credibility of the research that we're doing here.
Oh, no, I didn't say it as a criticism at all. I just said it that underscored the degree of alarm.
For sure,
usually,
for sure.
Yes. So walk us through. You identified five states in the last report that I read that illustrate the point dramatically. Could you course us through the five states and why these five states are so very important to look at?
Well, sure. I mean, the states that we looked at were Michigan, Texas, New Mexico, North Carolina, and Mississippi. And I think what's really important about this collection of states is that they on an aggregate level do, I think, a pretty good job of highlighting the range of issues around race and ethnicity as they impact, economic issues. Frankly, we also had a couple of funders that were particularly interested in some of those states, but that's kind of a secondary consideration. What we find, looking at Michigan in particular, is an unemployment rate among African Americans, in the most recent quarter of 2012, that was literally 2.5 times the unemployment rate for white workers. That really should be setting off alarm bells for folks. And it points to me to the need to address that problem, at a systemic level, through immediate attention now, but also through attention to longer term solutions that can really help to close that gap over time.
Michigan tops the list, you said, but there are four others. Walk us through those.
Well, so the other states, in Texas, we actually found in Texas there was a range of, there was similar disparities by race and ethnicity, but overall Texas was actually faring better than the nation as a whole, so that was, relatively a positive thing. In New Mexico, the interesting thing about New Mexico is that on the face of it, their numbers look not quite so troubling. But when you dig a little bit deeper, again, you see the significant disparity between white non-Hispanic workers and Hispanic workers. And, you know, particularly among states in the South, you know, Texas and New Mexico, Mississippi too, the fact that ongoing immigration issues will make the importance of addressing, you know, those gaps, particularly with Hispanic workers, you know, addressing those now, sort of nip the problems in the bud before they fester and become really problematic is really the critical thing to do. Then in Mississippi, there we have an African American unemployment rate of 14.3%. It's actually interesting if you take a look at the ratio between white and African American unemployment by states. You know, while it's true that Michigan, for example, is the top of the list in terms of the overall unemployment rate, in terms of the ratio that you see there, it actually is kind of in the middle of the pack. Michigan falls ninth among states, or tenth if you include D.C. And you know, at the upper end, you've actually got D.C. and then Ohio that has a rate that's, you know, even greater yet than Michigan. And a state like Mississippi is actually second highest on that list. So, you know, again, there's the overall rate, and then there's where it stands with respect to other racial groups. And I think both points are equally important and merit our attention and focus. I mean, frankly, in a state like Michigan, for example, you know, one of the most dramatic things that we've seen over the last 5 years was the relative success of the process of saving the auto sector. You know, Michigan started off the recession sort of very much leading the pack in terms of unemployment rates and managed to bring those numbers down, you know, so that they're no longer, I think they've now broken out of the top 10, but certainly they're no longer in lead, and certainly not, you know, in the top 3 where they were for so much of the recession. And, you know, an improvement like that obviously, is felt across all race and ethnicities. In terms of their employment prospects. So, you know, there's some sort of good news there. Obviously, the not-so-good news is that Michigan continues to be a state that's hampered by, you know, significantly above average, above the national average unemployment rates, and has had very minimal, if any, real population growth during that time as well. So you'd be hard-pressed to say that Michigan's on an extraordinarily healthy path. But what troubles me more is some of the policies that have been pursued in order to get control of the state budget situation there. And some of those things are short-sighted things that we see in other states as well. Things like rolling back a state earned income tax credit, cutting back on unemployment insurance benefits when people obviously need them more than ever before. Those are the types of policies that really are very much penny-wise and pound-foolish.
And I want to note that these figures represent, that do not take into account those people who simply have given up looking for jobs. They do not include the working age teenage population that is eligible to find jobs but cannot. And it doesn't take into consideration people who are employed just cyclically. So the figures are really dismal if you were to put all of that together. It's not news, I don't think, for the federal government that there's this disparity, and organizations like yours attract these things, I'm sure, have been seeing the same pattern over and over again. What does it take to get a sensible approach in Congress? For example, I read also in one of the reports, in one of your reports, even if jobs were generated at the rate of 175,000 per month, it will not be until 2020 before we find some stability in the labor market. So how, therefore, does the market get corrected? What has to happen?
Well, there's a bunch of things that need to happen. First and foremost, we need to reverse this trend of austerity that really is crippling the economy for those, really for all families, but in particular for those that are continuing to struggle with unemployment. As I mentioned, addressing that issue, the issue of the debt and deficit as though it's the primary issue, is completely off target. And obviously, you're asking what can we do to fix the jobs crisis. Well, what we can do to fix the jobs crisis is focus on it and adopt policies that reflect that as a number one priority. You know, trillions of dollars came out of the economy as a result of the collapse of the housing bubble. And it really is the role of government, and in particular the federal government, to step in and help to fill that hole over the short term. Really, in fact, right now, the federal deficit is the friend of our economy, and we should be actually increasing that deficit to help get the economy back on track. There's lots of time down the road to address the long-term debt issues, which are also very real, but addressing those now actually undermines the ability to address them appropriately over the longer term.
I have to ask you a question as an economist. You're saying that now is the time to really extend the deficit by stimulating the jobs market and therefore stabilizing the economy. What kind of theory, to the best of your knowledge, is the Obama administration following? What is the economic philosophy that they're following other than cut the deficit, which is really not an economic theory or philosophy as such? To the best of your ability, could you describe what you think might be the operative economic theory that they're following?
So my sense would be that they're not adhering religiously to any particular theory, and instead they're probably going for what they might consider to be a quote-unquote balanced approach. And unfortunately, that leaves them kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, not getting the kind of results that we would like to see. You know, and frankly, you know, there's only so much that the administration can do without a cooperative Congress. And I think that they, you know, their approach is extraordinarily pragmatic in that sense, and unfortunately reflects the realities of the electoral situation that we're faced with.
So then explain a little bit why it makes sense to not worry too much about the deficit for the moment and instead concentrate on generating jobs.
Well, it's a pretty basic macroeconomic, foundational tenet that, you know, demand is comprised of a bunch of different components. We know that in a weak economy, we're not getting consumption. We know that with state governments hurting, we're losing, we're losing at that level. And it's really just the federal government that can help to spend the dollars that are needed to keep our economy humming, and get it back on track. I mean, it really very much is like, for example, we had the Recovery Act spending that really did, you know, contrary to what some would have you believe, that really did make a significant positive impact on the economy. And what actually happened was, you know, once that 2 or 3 year period had expired, it was as though the administration was letting their gas off the pedal. And as a result, we ended up with, you know, slowed growth, still continued growth, but as you point out, you know, if you were projecting the current rate of job gain over, you know, a significant number of years, you'd be a lot of years down the road before we got back to the same level of unemployment that we had when the recession began. And that's not acceptable, but more to the point, it's not necessary. You know, we could get there more quickly if we adopted smarter policies. At the state level, there's things that can be done as well, things that can and should be done. First of all, states should be avoiding at all costs, making the situation worse by imposing state budget cuts on top of what's already happening at the federal level. Instead, they should be looking for ways to generate new revenues, in particular, making sure that the wealthy are paying their fair share, that corporations are paying their fair share. And only by doing so can they continue to make the sorts of investments, you know, investing in our schools, investing in, you know, quality early care and education, closing the achievement gap for kids, all those sorts of things that will have an impact, certainly in terms of closing the employment gap between white workers and non-white workers, but also in terms of putting the overall state economy on a better track down the road. You know, anything that we do right now to, increase tuition costs, it's just providing an impediment to today's youth being able to get the education and training they need to contribute fully to their economy and their society down the road. So it really is a matter of, first doing no harm. It's kind of like
Hippocratic oath.
Exactly, right?
First do no harm.
And then states should also be, looking to invest in infrastructure. I mean, they can't run deficits, but they can borrow money to do things like build roads and schools. They can borrow money to make sure that their schools are more green. There's things along those lines that are critical and can really make a difference in a state's economy.
Well, the final question, the economy is certainly not just about money. It's also about the way we will be living as a society. And when these deep cleavages are created, the impact is even more devastating. It creates an even wider gap between rich and poor. Do you think they get that?
Do I think who gets that?
The administration. Do you think they really get this? That if things go on the way they are, this inattention to creating a stable economy, are setting the nation up to be deeply divided along racial lines, because there will be an intersection between rich and poor, and you will have that added burden to actually even out what people see as their just desserts in life. They cannot achieve what they need to achieve because it's going to cost money, and they don't have money. They don't have jobs. They don't have money. Communities deteriorate. The racial situation becomes even more tense, and the wider implication of the gap between rich and poor. So when these economic decisions are made, they're made purely on what looks good on paper, it seems, and what politics would sanction. They say, well, this is good for us. We scored a win. But are they, to your view, are they being really insightful when they make these kinds of decisions purely on the basis of politics and what looks good on paper, without understanding that there are deep social consequences to their economic policies?
Well, here's how I'd answer that. I would say that there is a disturbing amount of evidence that shows that in recent years, and really over, a period of several decades, there has been a significant shift in economic power and in income and even in democratic power, towards the rich and the powerful, towards corporate interests. And, the current administration, has paid lip service certainly to changing some of those directions, but I don't think that we've seen the type of, significant overhauls that would really clearly signal that we've seen a sea change and that things are heading back in a positive direction. I think that there still certainly is hope, but it's also fair to say that a lot more could and should be done.
Well, Doug Hall, thank you very much for your insightful interview today. It helped us understand quite a bit.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for your work.
Thank you so much. We'll take a break and come back to your thoughts, and we'll pick up a little bit from yesterday right after this. Yeah, that's Randy Weston on piano. Very, very fantastic musician from the People's Democratic Republic of Brooklyn. He passed away some time ago, but made his mark before he left. You're listening to Lead Stories, and Yeah, I'm your trees lead. I keep forgetting to tell people that. You can continue the discussion with me at all times. Drop me a note at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com, or on my Facebook page, Lead Stories with You Trees Lead. 888-874-4888, and it's time for us to connect with each other. Hello, Jay from New York.
Oh, how you doing, you tweets? I've really been enjoying the work and the stuff that you've been laying out to us in your audience. One quick thing. You know, a couple of weeks ago, they had a discussion or a debate or whatever you want to call it when Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas made the statement that the only reason Obama was elected because it was with the approval of the elite. And, you know, a lot of people have made the assertion that that's not true. But the more and more you look into the history of Obama, and also someone that we really have never truly looked at, but is an integral part, his wife, Michelle Obama, one would have to come to the conclusion and recognize that he was put into office by the elite. Now, when I say and speak of Michelle Obama, the thing that has amazed me from the beginning of them coming into the public view on this grand stage and becoming the president of the United States is that the media never thoroughly vetted Michelle Obama. Because if they would have thoroughly vetted Michelle Obama, they would have found out that she was almost disbarred. And the only reason why she wasn't disbarred was because she decided to not renew her law license as part of the condition of her not being disbarred because of an insurance scam that she was involved with through the very big law firm that she worked for at the time. And then she landed a cush job with Chicago, I think, State Hospital, I think it was. And through her working with Chicago State Hospital, I think it was, she really, really tore apart the ability of minorities to come to that hospital to get care. She made it to where they could no longer come to that hospital, but had to go to other hospitals. Matter of fact, it was Chicago University, hospital. But I wish at one point in time you would really further investigate what I just spoke to you about and do a program on that, because I believe that if it was any other candidate that wife had that type of mark against her within this political atmosphere, it's no way in heaven they would be able to become the president. And as you can see, as he has become the president, things have definitely not gotten better for the everyday American. You were talking yesterday about his speech.
Yes, go ahead. Finish it up so I can get a word in.
Okay, let me just say this. The one thing that bothered me the most about his speech was he was talking about, I'm elected to take care of the middle class and to have the middle class grow. Never spoke about poor and underprivileged people or even other Americans.
Well, thank you. I'm reacting to what you're offering today on a couple of levels. Number one, it is considered not good, just not good manners, for lack of a better term, to attack the spouses of the individual running for office. It's considered not the good thing to do. However, there is a place for it if if it's viewed in context. And I think the estimation of Barack Obama as a politician would have to consider all things pertaining to him, including possibly Michelle Obama's role, and increasingly she's, you know, taking on a more and more visible role in his second term, which she had originally said she was just not going to do. But, you know, she has a prerogative to do whatever it is she needs to do, and the more exposure that she gets within a specifically political realm, the more it invites close scrutiny. So that much I could say. Clarence Thomas's view, I mean, I don't understand why people are getting all excited because he actually said something. He has made a full career of just remaining quiet. So he should continue that, remain quiet until his days on the Supreme Court are up. President Obama is a very important political figure for the African-American community, especially to understand. And, you know, we talk about, as you did, referring to you, Jay, when you said, well, when he became president. No, not when he became president. It's when people put him into the presidency. We always have to rephrase these things, because when you say when he became president, you shift the axis of power. The axis of power always rested with the people who put him into office. He could be as brilliant as ever. If he didn't get the votes, if he didn't get the support, if he didn't get the boots running from house to house, knocking on doors, dragging people out to vote and doing the grunt work of lifting him into political orbit, he would not be president of the United States. We always have to remember that. Barack Obama is the reflection of the investment people have made in him, as is any other candidate. Any other candidate, if people reach the point where they're so arrogant that they believe that they are in office because of who they are, well, then they're wrong. They're in office because of who the people are. The people put them there. So that is something we always have to remind ourselves about. The speech yesterday, and I was so delighted I got a lot of feedback, lots of emails and observations. And what delights me is the fact that we are engaging in purposeful and critical thought. And you are listening for things that are not said as well. Imagine all of this came to the audience, as you heard it one after the other, where they correctly zeroed in on what the significance of the speech was. What is it that he intended? Here is a man who clearly himself was not as familiar with Morehouse as he pretended to be in a speech. You could tell there was a slight disconnect there. And you go to a commencement, which is about congratulating these men, these graduates of achieving yet another step in life and coming out of a tradition. This is a very, very traditional school. This is one of the last remaining, the historically black colleges and universities are the last remaining bastions of re-socialization in our society for people of color, to be rooted and to be connected with a culture and with a historical point of reference that they would need for the rest of their lives. Clearly, Mr. Obama did not have that. So he assumed that his ignorance about this aspect of culture was universal, and therefore proceeded to preach to people who already know what the deal is. When you get into Morehouse, you are thoroughly oriented as to its history and why it is the way it is and why it does the things it does. I will never forget what my older brother one day coming home and saying, well, this is my last day at Columbia University. And my mother almost fell to the floor because she couldn't figure out what kind of craziness are you saying? You are leaving Columbia University? And he said, yes. And she said, well, why? And he said, I'm not learning anything there. I'm going instead to Howard. To Howard? He said, yes. Now, mind you, he was at 17 years old. He was the operator, or part of the operation, I should say, of a critical point in an oil refinery system called the Cat Cracker. And the Cat Cracker is the catalytic cracker, is really what it's short for. It's the part of the refinery that distills the crude oil into all its various byproducts. And he was doing that at 17 and got to Columbia and just wasn't learning anything. Went to Howard, where he had to literally buy his test tubes and buy everything he needed, and had to, you know, hunch over because of all kinds of things that were not necessarily conducive to a luxurious student experience, but was ecstatic because he was learning at Howard University. Now, that is the tradition, and Barack Obama would not understand that. So he betrayed that yesterday when he congratulated one of the students, saying, oh, and he's now on his way to Harvard Law. Oh, well, great. You know, our president is slightly disconnected. We know that. And what we are hoping to do is to contain the damage that he has done. And it's the best that we could hope for right now, to contain the damage and, you know, leave the rehabilitation to him and whoever else is interested in rehabilitating him politically. That's not our job. Our job is to protect ourselves. And we have a right to protect ourselves from the political damage that this president continues to do. We will be back tomorrow, of course, at 1 o'clock. I'm encouraging you to make those calls to the office of Congresswoman Frederica Wilson at 202-225-4506. Encourage her, please, to call the president and ask that the children from Haiti be reunited with their families in the United States today. 202-225-4506, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Thank you so much for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Bye-bye.